I was a little I'm a little humbled to be asked to do that, because I haven't actually done that many interviews over the years. I mean, in 25 years, I should have done probably hundreds, and I've done more like dozens. I have done enough where I've learned some things and would like to do a lot more. The first thing I ever did was a guy named Elon Chief Hogsett, who lived out in the middle of Kansas. I believe it was in roughly 1991 or 92. Norman Mock, who I think was running the committee at that point, he probably sent me a letter asking me if I would talk to Hogsett. And I called, I got Hogsett on the phone, and he said he didn't want to do it. He sounded like he was sort of grumpy and didn't really like talking on the phone. I called him at least once more, maybe the third time. He said, yeah, all right, come on out. So we picked a time, and I drove out to, I believe he lived in Salina, Kansas, somewhere in the middle of the state. Long drive. If you've ever driven across Kansas, you know what I mean. We had a great talk. He didn't really remember many specifics. I would ask him about certain players. He might have a one-word response. I'd ask him about I asked him about some people he played with in the minors, and he didn't remember them at all. I think he was in his probably early to mid-80s. But, you know, he was great. We sat at his kitchen table, and I brought a baseball, and he sort of gripped it and showed me how he held his pitches. And the one thing that my favorite part of the interview was, I don't remember how it came up, but he explained to me in some detail that he had absolutely no Indian blood in him, even though his nickname was Chief, which I found fascinating because I'd done a lot of research. I'd gotten the Hall of Fame file and pored over it. And when he was a player, it was common, you know, conventional, common knowledge that he was 1/4 Cherokee or whatever it was. And there were photos of him wearing a ceremonial headdress, and that someone had given him. And he told me it was all bunk, that somebody had just given him that nickname when he was a child, and it just stuck. Funny part of the story is that I probably held on to the cassette tape for at least a year because I wanted to transcribe it, and I was even less organized then than I am now, I suppose. So it took me a while, and I finally sent the tape to Norman. I never heard back. I don't even know if it's in the collection at this point. I hope so, because later a book came out, and I don't remember which one, but it had an interview with Hogsett, which would have been done roughly the same time I did mine, and he was very specific about having Indian heritage. So there is this conflict here, which I have never seen justified. Was he really part Indian? And if my tape is lost, because I lost a transcript years ago, you know, it's like 4 dead computers ago. Without my tape, there might not be anything out there that suggests that he was not actually an Indian, which would be interesting if you were trying to write something significant about him. So you just never know what's going to come up. In the years since, I haven't done many full-blown interviews, but I've done research for various books, called someone to talk for 10, 15 minutes. And I've generally found it's difficult for me to call somebody on the phone cold, even now after all these years. But I have found that for the most part, they're very friendly. It's funny, I can probably remember very specifically just the only one or two times when I'd call somebody and they would just shoot me down and say they don't want to talk about it. But for the most part, people are great. I think it's probably going to be different for the next generation of researchers. You know, these guys who played in the 70s and 80s and made a lot more money, had a lot more demands on their time, I think they're going to be a lot tougher to get to. For one thing, you can't just find their phone number as easily as you can with the older guys, or at least used to be able to. For the most part, when I've wanted to contact players from the 40s or 50s and into the 60s, it's been pretty easy to find them. And you call them, and for the most part, they're happy to talk. And I guess that's obvious. We see so many books now written by these guys, like whole books by a guy, you know, a PCL star from the 70s from the 50s did a book a few years ago. It's actually quite good. I think they really do just enjoy telling their stories. I've always had a great time talking to them. I should do more. We have some ex-major leaguers in Portland that I'm sure they have not all been talked to yet. And they're great. We have lots of Portland Mavericks. I don't know if you guys have seen the Portland Mavericks documentary that just got released a couple of weeks ago, but a lot of Portland Mavericks still in the area, and I'm hoping to talk to some of them. And glad you mentioned the minor leagues, because that's a wellspring of great material. There's so many great stories, so many interesting teams, and of course a lot of Sabre members have that interest. And I mean, it's obscure, sure, but as we drill down and we do more interviews with the major leaguers, we have to go somewhere. And I think the minor leagues is very fertile ground for interviews. And a lot of those guys played with players who wind up in the majors, even if the interview subject didn't. So I think that's a great avenue for anybody who's looking for, especially if it's someone in your area. It may be tougher to find because they aren't in the books, but you know, you ask around, go to games, see scouts. A lot of those guys played in the minors. I think they could all be great to talk to. As far as tips, you know, be prepared, obviously, as has been mentioned. That's key. I read a great tip recently from John McPhee, who's been writing for The New Yorker for so many years, and he said sometimes he'll ask a question and he'll get an answer, and then he'll sort of pause and then ask the same question again as if he's an idiot, and he'll get a different answer, and that might be more illuminating than the first answer. Another thing that's very difficult, I think, to do, but is important, is don't feel like you need to fill every pause with something. It can feel awkward, but you know, a 10-second pause might just be your subject collecting his thoughts, and he might jump in with something that he just thought of. Maybe he's feeling awkward and wants to add something else. It might be something he didn't want to share the first time because it's a little controversial or a touchy subject, but I think you feel like you should be doing all the work because you're imposing on this person, but ultimately your duty is not to that person. You have some duty toward that person, but your duty is to the story and to history. You know, ultimately, neither one of us are going to be around anymore. All that's going to be left is that interview. And you have to think about the person who's going to be using that interview for whatever wonderful purposes. And they're not really going to care if you or your subject were uncomfortable. You know, I think that you certainly need to be considerate, and you don't want to impose needlessly, but we're really doing this for posterity. And if someone's uncomfortable for 10 seconds and you get a better answer, I think that's worth it. So those are my main thoughts. I appreciate being here. Maybe it'll encourage me to go out and do more interviews. My goal is to do more books someday that involve this sort of work. I really have come to enjoy it more than anything else I do. Sitting down with someone and talking about baseball, I don't know that it gets much better than that. You know, I wish I had the Hogsett interview in my hand, which I don't. But one thing that we do have when we do these, you know, even the tape is on some level ephemeral, and it'll survive longer than we do. But, you know, for me, that's a lot more, you know, having sat down at Elon Hogsett's kitchen table for an hour or two, whatever it was, that's much more rewarding than getting his autograph. So, you know, to the extent that you can do that, really, I mean, you might think about collecting the words and the experience instead of collecting the interview or collecting the autograph or the signed baseball or whatever it might be. In fact, I actually had him sign a ball for me, and you know, very shaky hand. And this was before I knew that it really mattered which pen you use. You can't read that signature anymore, which is a sort of a good lesson for me, I think. You know, that's basically disappeared. It doesn't really mean anything, that baseball. But it really never did. What was important to me, or should have been, and I think is now, is just that experience of having been with him and soaking up a little bit of his knowledge and his memory. Any questions about any of that or anything else interview-wise? Yeah.
anybody here, but for as a not-for-profit, just trying to do this, any suggestions or tips on how to get help on the video without a lot of money? Video recording the interview?
You know, I really don't know. I mean, somebody here probably does. I know there are cameras that are relatively inexpensive, but like the whole setting them up, and I actually have never done a video interview. I don't know what the utility of that really is. Is there some advantage to the video, to doing it on video? I mean, I suppose on some of it might be easier to someday make a transcript if you can actually see the person enunciating and figure out what they were, you know, and see their facial expressions and get a sense for their. I think, you know, for the historical record, it would be nice someday, and you know, it'd be nice in 20 years to be able to watch a video of Elon Hogsett talking. For research purposes, I'm not sure what the advantage would be.
But there's a company called Zoom, and they make little handheld. Mainly digital voice recorders, roughly the size of the one you show, but a little larger. And they have one model that's in the roughly 175 to 250 range that also has video. And it's not going to be, it's just a step down in quality than, say, your iPhone video, but still it works, long lasting memory. And the digital recorder on it works really well, you know, on top of that. And forget the model name, forget the specifics, but the company's Zoom, and they have a good, handy, all-in-one thing, and then you can just plug it straight into the computer, just uploads it to the computer in MP3 for the digital, and then just whatever file the video is, and it's a pretty neat, fairly inexpensive, handy tool for interviews and just video in general.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that I sometimes will do interviews just by hand if I don't have the phone handy, or because the phone works really well for the interviews too. And obviously, by hand is not as good a record. But if you do wind up talking to someone, it might be for 5 or 10 minutes. If you do that, it's very important to transcribe that interview as quickly as you possibly can, because you will remember. At least I remember pretty specifically what was said in between the gaps where I couldn't write fast enough. I think that's certainly better than nothing, especially for very specific pieces of information. You know, if one were writing a book, one would want to be skeptical of a handwritten interview. I do those sometimes, depending on the situation, and those are better than, I think those are better than nothing. Especially, you know, it might just give you a guide for something to ask next time you talk to the person. You know, if you happen to run into somebody, and you get the 10 minutes, it might be good to just write things down as you're doing this. And but it's incredibly helpful to as soon as you can sit down with it before you go to bed that night, basically, and type in your notes and what you remember.
You would elaborate a little on your own preparation for an interview. If you were to interview Hogsett today, what sources would you rely on, and how would you go about approaching something like that?
Well, I interviewed Artie Wilson a few years ago, a great Negro leaguer and Pacific Coast League player. I did the same thing. I got his Hall of Fame file. In both cases, these were significant stacks of paper, and I just read through all of them, and then I made up a list of questions based on everything. I also did the with Hogsett. I also went through and made a list of his great teammates. He didn't remember much about. He didn't have much to say about his teammates. I'll never forget, though. I asked him about Goose Goslin, and he said the goose was for the goose. And I asked him what he meant by that. He said, goose was for the goose. And it was very frustrating because I wanted more, right? Obviously, he was remembering 60 years earlier. You know, that stuck with me. I don't know that I would ever use it because I don't know what it means. And I've read many things about Goslin since and have never read anything like that. But certainly you want to know who his teammates were, which teams he played for, and... even if you don't use those with specific questions, things will come up, and my assumption is that when you seem to have a very strong knowledge of his career, you'll be a little friendlier.
Do
you know, that you've, some players maybe not, some players yes, but just the fact that you took the time to learn about his career, I think probably with some players would carry some weight, you know, to know that you did the research and you're not just somebody who blows in and doesn't really know anything about the guy.
You feel it's any different interviewing modern players? You were saying before you can't reach the current guys in the phone book and so forth, but are the interviews you receive from players, say, post-1980 different in content than you get from players prior?
Well, I think that the current players, the recent players, have certainly been have done a lot more interviews, have told the same stories over and over more, probably. I think they're harder to get to. But, you know, there are commonalities. One thing that you know, there are icebreakers. For example, I think talking to any player, but certainly a current player or recent player about how hard he worked, how he prepared for the game. You know, the baseball has become more and more professional over the years. You know, players get to the ballpark at, 10 or 11 o'clock every morning, and they're there until 10 or 11 at night or later. And they work very hard, and I think they take a great deal of pride in that, the recent players. So asking how they prepare for a game, asking them what they do in the off season to get ready for the next season. These are all good icebreakers because that sort of, you know, you make the point that you understand how hard they worked to get where they are. And I think anyone in any walk of life appreciates being asked how they do their job. I don't know that you lead with, you have to lead with, you know, tell me a funny story about this player. You know, that's great too. But I think establishing that you understand that they're a professional and worked hard to get where they got, I think that's a pretty good start. And then you can launch into the fun stuff later. Yeah, Paul?
One thing you said that sort of really struck me was the pregnant pause part. You know, it's really, I think, important to sort of try to figure out how your subject speaks or thinks and how quick he's going to be. I did an interview with Delegas years ago. And I just I really didn't do a very good job at all because Dale just was quiet. He didn't say anything. These long pauses, and I felt like I had to fill the void. And I think what I was doing is I was redirecting him all the time instead of letting him just, you know, think through and say what he wanted to say. I was changing subjects. And, you know, I just didn't do a very good job. On the other hand, I interviewed Harry the Hat Walker, and I asked one question. 15 minutes later, he stopped talking, you know.
Right.
You really have to try to be sensitive to and figure out how they work.
Right, and I think that one of the secrets to doing good interviews is being able to talk to people. And that's stating the obvious. But I think the older you get and the more people you've talked to, the easier it is to find some commonality with your... I'm looking around the crowd. I'm not seeing a lot of high school students in here. So probably not an issue. We've probably all had a lot of time to talk to people. But for me, it's just the older I've gotten, the easier it's been to interview or talk to anyone. That's just experience. And everybody's different. And there's not one interview technique that works for everybody. You just need to talk to the person and get to know them a little bit and kind of get a feel for how they communicate. That's exactly right. Yep.
One of the problems with oral histories is misremembrances.
Right.
And when someone comes up and they're talking about something that doesn't match the historical record, do you jump in and try to get the correction and get the correction into it? Or if you don't even know that there's a misremembrance there, and you're transcribing later, do you put in brackets, and how do you massage the interview in your transcription?
I think that Larry Ritter did it the best way you can do it, which is most of the time he corrected it in the book and didn't say that he was correcting it. Occasionally, and very occasionally, he would put an asterisk, and it would just be, there'd be a footnote at the bottom saying, well, it didn't quite happen like that. But he changed, I did a little research project a few years ago for one of my books, And I actually went back and compared what Ritter, what's in The Glory of Their Times and what's actually on the tapes. And it's a lot different. He changed a lot of stuff. Even though he said that he hadn't changed much at all, he did. I mean, the memories of those guys was not very good. They did tell incredible stories, which is what makes the book so wonderful. But Ritter also did a great deal of cutting and pasting and making those guys sound both more articulate and more accurate than they actually were, which, again, is exactly what you'd expect given that they were recounting things that had happened 50 or more years ago. I think that I wouldn't jump in, no, which is kind of a shame because it would be great if you could later have the transcript him reciting the perfect history. But you know, I think it's better to just let the stories flow. And if they get the details wrong, they get the details wrong. And if you want to write a book about it, you know, and put it in a footnote or bracket or whatever you want to do, great. But I would rather have the unalloyed memories. And if they're wrong, they're wrong.
Well, plus you want to keep them talking, right? I
mean, that's right.
If you point out that something is wrong, then they might clam up.
Right. You know, sometimes they might sound unsure and say, I don't quite remember. And then I think it's perfectly appropriate to say, well, I think, you know, I was just doing some research yesterday and this happened on this date. Great. But no, I think it's better to just let it flow and don't get in the way.
8:30, so...
Good to see everybody. Thanks for having me.